The next session is the climate change feedback from the ASSA Working Party on Climate Change Mortality and Morbidity Impacts and the IFOA Working Party on Climate Stress and Scenario Testing. I'd like to call on Pamela Heerling and Adele Drew while I introduce them. Pamela is the head of Insights Life Solutions and the chair of the Climate Change Impacts on Mortality and Morbidity Working Group. She has a keen interest in helping to shape the way in which the life insurers respond and adapt to the real and regulatory impacts of the impending climate crisis. Adele Drew is a senior risk consultant working for Milliman, London and Cape Town, helping clients to develop and to mature risk management capabilities and build resilience, including climate and sustainable topics. Thank you.
I don't need to stand close to the mic. Good morning, everyone. Thank you, Zandi, for the introduction. As Zandi said, my name's Pamela Heerling, and I've been involved in a working party tasked with investigating the impact of climate change on mortality and morbidity specifically. Before I give an update on the work we've been doing, I'd like to address the elephant in the room and, I guess, test the technology today and ask you to complete a poll. So I believe you got an email this morning that might have a link in it that will take you to the polling website. And the question I'm asking you to answer, what level of risk do you feel climate change poses to the mortality and morbidity risks of life and health insurers in South Africa? High risk, moderate risk, or low risk? And I believe you probably don't consider climate change a very high risk for your mortality and morbidity experience, because that's kind of the consensus I get when I talk to people, that climate change, at least currently, isn't a high risk, specifically on the liability side of the balance sheet. And that's a side that's affected by physical risks of climate change, which are the direct physical impacts like floods and droughts and rising sea levels and things like that. There's a bit more buy-in that it may affect the asset side of the balance sheet, which is more affected by transition risk, which, you know, refers to the economic cost of moving to or transitioning to a low carbon economy. But even that doesn't seem to be too great a priority for life insurers at the moment. And that's what we're seeing in the industry as well. I don't know if you guys can see the results, but as expected, 14% say high risk. Everyone else thinks that it's a low or moderate risk. And that is what we're seeing in the industry. If we go back to the slideshow, RGA recently released a report in which they talk about the results of an industry survey they undertook recently. They spoke to 17 life and health insurers in South Africa about their opinion on climate change. And 85% of the respondents said that they expect a low or moderate risk to arise from climate change for life insurers. This is climate change in general, not specifically the mortality and morbidity risks, which I assume would be treated, you know, with even lower priority. In the same survey, 55% of respondents said that they are placing no or low priority on preparing for the impacts of climate change on their business. And this is kind of what we're seeing overseas as well. In February this year, the Geneva Association published a report in which they had interviewed 41 key informants, coincidentally also representing 17 insurers and reinsurers in North America, Europe, and Asia. And the consensus among those interviewees was that, at least in the short term, climate change does not pose a great risk to their businesses. There is, however, and they don't expect it to really affect the insurability or affordability of their products. There is consensus that this may change over the longer term, especially given the increased scale, frequency, and severity of climate events. And because we're set to actually breach that 1.5 degree threshold as early as 2027. Now, I can understand why insurers may feel this way. Until now, at least, I suspect not many life insurers have actually seen a material change in their mortality and morbidity that can be ascribed to climate change. if it is going to happen, it's probably going to happen in the longer term beyond the traditional business planning cycle, also time horizon of 3 to 5 years. Secondly, research has been done which shows that South Africa probably won't experience material impact to its mortality due to climate change, at least not compared to other countries around the world. For example, this is an extract from the study done by Chen et al. Earlier this year. The red box is South Africa and a list of countries. And this study suggested that the impact of climate change would be very low. There'd be very few additional deaths due to climate change. In fact, for cold-related deaths, it may even be a positive thing. RGA also presented an excellent piece of work in March this year, also suggesting that there'll be very few excess deaths that can be ascribed to climate change in South Africa. Another reason not to really worry about this risk is that many life insurance products are subject to repricing, so we can always just price our way out of trouble if we need to. And then for those who may be more familiar with climate change research, you may know that it's been shown that adaptation measures can go a long way to offsetting the impact of climate change on our health and well-being. So for those policyholders who can afford air conditioning and the electricity that goes with it, we may not need to worry that much. And then the argument that always wins, there are so many non-climate-related fires to put out that are clamoring for our resources and attention, so why should we worry about this one? These are all excellent arguments. They form a solid steel man, and they may very well be true. But there is a four-letter F word that may come to mind when thinking about how to measure the impact of climate change on mortality and morbidity. I feel it's quite a problematic word that shouldn't be uttered in professional company. That word is feel. As actuaries, we don't deal in feelings, and I say that in the most affectionate way. We deal in evidence, in data, in science, and in facts. So while it may very well be the case that the impact of climate change on our mortality and morbidity will be minimal, each insurer needs to justify that assumption based on their specific set of circumstances. It's not enough just to feel like there won't be an impact. Another reason to care is that while some research suggests that there won't be material impacts, there is a lot of research that suggests that there will be a notable impact on our well-being, specifically on the morbidity and health side. Happy to share those resources with anyone who's interested. And then, apart from dealing in evidence and data and science and facts, the other thing we deal with is regulation. As life insurers and as actuaries, we know that the three certainties in life are death, taxes, and regulation. And in the Prudential Authority's proposed guidance on climate-related risk practices for insurers, which was released last year, you can find sentences that say things like, insurers should be acutely aware of portfolio exposures to climate-related risks and where such exposures have a material impact on decision-making. Some climate-related risks may take longer to fully materialize, and insurers should ensure that the also includes appropriate scenarios with extended time horizons. If climate-related risks are assessed as not material, this should be clearly documented and explained in the ORSA. Now, we don't know exactly when insurers are going to have to start reporting on this risk, but we can reasonably expect some kind of best practice guidance to be released in the next year or so. The point is that this risk, which is climate-related impacts on mortality and morbidity, may not be material. But as life insurers and as actuaries, we need to make assumptions about the future based on our own experience, based on published research, based on professional judgment. And then we need to be able to assess and evidence justification for these assumptions. And this evidence gathering does not need to be the most sophisticated model in the world. In fact, the Prudential Authority really advocates a pragmatic and risk-based approach. And it's actually an area where a lot of the hard work can be done for you, and that's where our working party comes in. So we started our work at the beginning of this year, and our objective is to deliver a framework that all South African insurers can use to assess and quantify the impact of climate change on their mortality and morbidity risks. In other words, our mission is to do the hard work for you. And I think one of the major challenges of dealing with climate change is that it's so big and all-encompassing that it can feel overwhelming, and you don't know where to start, and that leads to some form of paralysis, and you end up doing nothing. So our working party has kept our scope very contained and well-defined. We're only looking at the direct impacts of climate change on mortality and morbidity. We're not considering the second-order impacts on expenses, lapses, asset values, the macroeconomy. We're not even really considering the impacts of adaptation in any great level of detail. We're purely looking at the physical risks of climate change and their direct impact on our mortality and morbidity. So with that being said, I'd like to give you a taste of what the working party has been up to and is planning. As I'm going through this proposed framework, I'd really appreciate it if you could think about how each step might be applied to your business. And you know, think about feedback you'd like to give to the working party. It's really intended to be a living, useful document, so we'll heavily rely on your feedback. So we believe that climate change should be treated like any other risk to our assets and liabilities. So in structuring this framework, we followed a typical risk management control cycle. So we have sections for identify, assess, manage, monitor, and modify. The identify and assess sections have been heavily influenced by the excellent work done by the team at SCORE, specifically Dr. Irene Merck, who's the Emerging Risk Ambassador. I'd highly recommend her series of papers on the relevance of climate change for life and health insurance. So if we start with identify, from a risk management perspective, climate change is best described as an overarching trend from which specific risks or impacts emerge. So in other words, you can think of climate change as an umbrella term, and to analyze it meaningfully, we need to tease out the individual impacts or risks, also known as hazards, drivers, or perils, and figure out what they might do to our business. These risks are quite far-ranging, and they vary quite a lot depending on geographic region. So the hazards that will affect South Africa the most with its hot, dry climate may be very different from those affecting a place like Singapore that has a more tropical, humid climate. Even within South Africa, you'll find differences. These hazards also vary a lot depending on the type of product you're looking at. So the hazards that are most pertinent to your fully underwritten book may be quite different from those faced by your funeral policyholders. That's why it's important that each life insurer undertakes an exercise to identify the hazards that might pose a risk to their specific business. So once you've come up with a list of hazards, you need to find a way to link them to your risks. And for mortality, it's quite straightforward. Mortality only results in one claim event, which is death. Morbidity, however, requires an extra layer of thinking. And research to date has shown that, you know, climate change could impact a wide variety of conditions, from cardiovascular disease to stroke to respiratory illnesses to mental illnesses, to name but a few. So each insurer needs to think about which conditions they're most exposed to or perhaps lead to the greatest claims, and then therefore which ones do they need to worry about the increased incidence of. And then they need to figure out which climate hazard will cause the exacerbation of those conditions. So as an example, this is also from the Geneva Association's report. They came up with a list of hazards, and hopefully your eyes are better than mine, but on the column lists all potential hazards like severe weather, droughts, flooding, air pollution, things like that. And it's quite easy to see how each of these hazards may cause death, perhaps some more than others. For morbidity, what they did is list all the potential conditions that may be exacerbated by climate change across the top, from cardiovascular diseases to allergies to antimicrobial resistance. And then for each hazard and for each condition, you know, you can kind of do a cross-reference to see which one is impacted by which. So cardiovascular disease will be exacerbated by, you know, heat stress and severe weather and so on. So then, once you've come up with this list of potential hazards, we need some way to quantify them through some kind of pathway or indicator. So for example, on the kind of heat stress or severe weather hazards, you may decide to look at something like weather data, which is quite easily available at any given level of granularity. For wildfires and air pollution, you could look at some kind of air quality index. And you can see some of these indicators will be easier to think of than others and also more readily available than others, which may influence your choice of hazard in the end. So then once we've reduced this big concept of climate change down into identifiable, measurable hazards and indicators, each insurer can undertake an exercise to figure out which hazards are going to be most applicable to them. And this will be dependent on a combination of that insurer's product offering, the geographic region and concentration of their policyholders, the age profile of their policyholders, and some kind of health or socioeconomic status indicator of the policyholders. Because all of these things will have you might have different hazards depending on, you know, different ages, geographic regions, and so on. So, for example, if we are an insurance company that offers funeral cover, life cover, severe illness, and also, why not, medical aid and hospital cash plan thrown in, we come up with a list of all our products, list the risk, in this case mortality or morbidity, that it's exposed to, and then for each of them come up with some kind of representative claim event that, you know, just makes it easy for us to understand what is, you know, what is the event that's going to cause the most claims. For the funeral and life cover, it's easy, it's death. In this case, we've chosen cardiovascular disease as the representative claim event for severe illness, asthma diagnosis for medical aid, and emergency room admission for hospital cash plan. You could obviously do more than one, but just to keep it simple as a first step, we're going with one each. And then for each of these claim events, what is the hazard that's going to have the biggest impact on it? So we've said for funeral cover and life cover, we think heat stress is what's going to cause the most excess deaths for our policyholders. And the indicator that goes with that is temperatures. So we can look at historical weather data, and you would do that for each of your products. So then once you've identified a hazard for each of your products and, you know, its associated indicator, you can start thinking about how to quantify the impact of these hazards. And we would want to do this for a variety of purposes, from pricing products in a hotter world to calibrating ORSA scenarios. So for example, if we do reach that 1.5 degree increase in a few years' time, how many extra deaths am I going to experience? How much extra capital do I need to hold? And depending on your size, maturity, and access to historical data, you could do this either by looking at published research and just adapting the results to fit your risk profile, or you can actually do a statistical investigation yourself. So in this case, where the insurance company has funeral cover, they might get hold of their historical exposure and claims data over the years, and then they can kind of identify the days on which they're seeing excess mortality. So this might be said at the 95th percentile level over, you know, as far back as they have data for. And then this company can get hold of historical temperature data and overlay it with your mortality data, and then where you see kind of crossovers between the excess mortality and very high temperatures, you can probably get an idea of how much this extra heat stress will affect your mortality. And this gives you an indication of how many extra deaths you can assume under any given scenario. So if you go with a 1.5 degree increase, you can probably estimate how many additional hot days you expect, and then, you know, multiply that by your excess number of deaths, and there you are. You can figure out some kind of adjustment to your rates. And this will vary, you know, by age, by sex, and by other things you can look at. So this is actually something that the working party has done a proof of concept on already. So we got hold of exposure and daily claims data on the mortality side from Alexander Forbes, and on the morbidity side from the aggregated Insight data universe. So we got data for claims for, I think, heart attacks, strokes, emergency room admissions, asthma attacks, things like that. We also got hold of daily weather data, which is freely available, and you can get it at a very granular level of detail. We got the ERA 5 data, which is the largest climate reanalysis produced by the European Centre for Medium Range Weather Forecasts. Then we, as in the previous example, identified the 95th percentile mortality morbidity events over the years that we had data for. We joined the two data sets based on postal code. And what I'm showing you now is very hot off the press and our very first look at what these results look like. And this is at kind of an aggregate level across South Africa, and we've just split it by gender for now. So on this graph, these graphs show like for each year temperature over the year, and then on the y-axis, that's on the y-axis, and then where you see the dots, that's where we have 95th percentile above mortality events. So where we're seeing the dots combined with very hot or very cold days, then we can, this may suggest a correlation between the two. So for example, there you see a cluster of dots in the summer, as you do in that graph. This graph shows not the absolute temperature, but residual, so how far the temperatures deviate from the mean. So where we see the dots clustered around large residuals, we can probably assume that there's some kind of impact of temperature volatility. So for example, there where we have very cold days and also excess mortality. This is on the morbidity side. This is, I think, heart attack and temperature. Also very early stages of analysis, but you can kind of see a few areas where we're seeing those 95th percentile events happening on very hot or very cold days. So, after assessing the impact of climate change on your mortality and morbidity, this will give you an indication of how material this risk may be to your business, and you can start managing it. And the assessment that you undertook will have an effect on various things and decisions you make. So, for example, governance strategy, risk management, and also these are all areas that the Prudential Authority is quite focused on. It may influence how you think about product design. Do you want to stop offering cover for certain conditions? Do you want to start offering cover for places where you see opportunities? Do you want to focus your sales strategy on portions of the population that are less vulnerable to climate change? Do we perhaps need to adjust the mortality and morbidity rates we use in pricing? Do we want to expand underwriting to include credit for adaptation measures? Do we need to exclude certain sectors of the population altogether? And then, of course, there are always marks for reinsurance. So you can think about whether you need to change your reinsurance structure. Can you negotiate better rates with your reinsurer if you can show that the impact of climate change will be negligible on your business? Then for monitoring, this kind of refers to the continuous recording and review of our risks, any mitigation or treatments we put in place, and any associated losses. And I think one of the major devices we have at our disposal to monitor risk and report on risk is scenario analysis. So in our framework, we'll talk about the different considerations to bear in mind when selecting a scenario. We'll also suggest various publicly available scenarios produced by organizations like the NGFS, the IPCC, and at some point the South African Reserve Bank. We'll also talk about kind of pitfalls and what to be careful of when you adapt these scenarios. But Adele has been leading a working party in the UK looking specifically at stress and scenario testing for climate change, so she'll talk about that a bit more in a few minutes. Then finally, we need to think about how to modify our approach as the risk and business environment changes over time, because our understanding of climate change is constantly adapting, and we'll need to constantly rethink our strategy, for example, as technology improves, as people are forced to migrate due to climate events, as society adapts, as our own risk management framework becomes more mature and evolves, and also as stakeholder attitudes change. So that refers to policyholders, shareholders, regulators, and everything in between. So this has been a snapshot of the work we've been doing and plan to do for the rest of the year. And I really hope you know, you'll engage with us. Please send any feedback, suggestions, comments you may have to PamelaH@insight.co.za, or come and talk to me. We'd really be interested in hearing how this framework could be made useful for you and your business. I really hope that this does not turn out to be a material risk for any life insurer or for South Africans in general, but we have to rely on more than a feeling to prove this. And over to Adele.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone. My name is Adele Drew. Thanks for setting me up, Pam, in the context of what I'll be talking about. I'm a senior consultant at Milliman. I specialize in climate and complex risks. I'm also a member of the Climate Change Impacts on Mortality and Morbidity Working Party. But I'm here today in my role as the chair of the IFA's Climate Stress and Scenario Testing Working Party, which is a complementary topic to what Pam has just presented on. The presentation today that I'll walk you through is the framework that we have developed for our climate stress and scenario testing, and along the way, we'll be demonstrating the principles of the framework with a very simplified example. So the example has been constructed by my working party purely to demonstrate how the framework would work in practice. As such, it is very simplified, and I must also apologize, it concentrates a lot on a UK narrative, but luckily we had arranged Richard earlier to kind of set up a UK context for us. So hopefully that doesn't distract from the purpose of the example, which is to demonstrate the application of the framework and not the content. So our working party was tasked with coming up with a multidisciplinary framework for performing climate stress and scenario testing. We were also asked to develop this framework to assess not only the potential financial impacts from particular types of climate risks, being physical or transition, or on assets and liabilities. It was meant to look beyond that at the various risks and opportunities from climate impacts. We were also asked to look beyond the short to medium term horizons, typically used by companies, for example, within the ORSA. So this aligns with the expectations from the PA that Pamela touched on earlier. What we've come up with is a framework for developing good climate narrative scenarios, and that is demonstrated in the image on the screen on the right. It's also a structured approach to developing these scenarios, such that they are transparent and can be updated as and when climate-related risks evolve. So in terms of the diagram, if I start on the top left, hopefully the first thing you'll notice is that it's an iterative process. If you start on the top left, we will bound the problem, and this is setting out the objectives for the stress and scenario test we're looking at. That moves on to identifying climate drivers on those objectives that we've defined. From there, we can develop a climate register based on those drivers identified, and then move into designing climate scenario narratives that are very bespoke and decision useful for your organization. The whole framework is meant to drive decision-taking or decision-making within the organization. So you'll see there's internally, there's a feedback into decisions. But there's also that testing component of it in the middle. And this is where quantitatively the climate impacts can come into play. So there's two routes into testing. The first is in developing the climate register. You move into the testing phase of doing targeted stress tests on certain variables or certain parameters to understand impacts of climate. And then that will also help define how we do design climate narratives on the next stage. The other element of testing is once you have climate narratives designed, how you move that from that scenario into testing it quantitatively. So the range of future outcomes is extremely vast, particularly when we talk about a topic as complex as climate. So the first step is really important, and this is about narrowing down the scope of what is really important to your business and the purpose for performing climate scenario testing in the first place. If we start a view of the outcomes that we're trying to avoid, It stops us from having that feeling of standing on the edge of space and just staring into the void where actually almost anything is possible. And that is a little bit what it feels like with climate, because it is in some cases an emerged risk, in some cases an emerging risk. There are so many possibilities in the future and so many ways that things can evolve that it's impossible to know exactly from today where things will progress. It's slightly easier to stand at the end and consider an objective that's been impacted and step that backwards to attach it to climate drivers in a way that would get you to impacting that objective that you care about. By using this approach, you're avoiding going down dead ends and already narrowing down the scope of the things that you'll be looking at. So I'll go into a bit more detail on that step in the process, but I was just trying to say why this step is so important to bound the objectives, to bound the problem and state the objectives that you're interested in. Part of defining your objective for performing scenario analysis will include questions like, what is the purpose of the exercise? What is the questions that we're trying to solve and trying to answer? Who will be using this information? And do we have any metrics in mind in terms of how we will be measuring this? So if I step into the example, we've created a fictitious life insurer based in the UK. They only sell to policyholders in the UK. They only sell whole of life products, and they've got a fixed sum assured. So again, all just very simplifying assumptions. And what they're interested to know is how the profitability of a whole of life insurance product may change in the future because of climate. So the types of things that that this insurer might be concerned about is how mortality might change, lapses might change, demand for this whole of life product or expenses. They will want to measure it against some sort of profitability target. And then if we consider sort of the different climate pathways, and by that I mean the pathways that have been set forward by the NGFS or the IPCC, there's no particular pathway we're interested in. We're more just trying to understand what the possibilities are and understanding if there is any extreme events that could occur and maybe tipping points as a result. So now with the objective in mind, we move on to identifying climate drivers on that objective. And this is where I was describing stepping from an objective back into a climate driver that you can attach to impacting that objective. The main aim here is to start teasing out the drivers, but also to start building a picture of where drivers are potentially interconnected or amplified. So at this stage, we're not yet looking at exposures. We're simply interested in understanding what various aspects could impact the objectives we care about. So our example, we were interested in mortality, lapse, demand, and expense. So if we just use mortality as an example and describe how we can step that back into a climate driver, this is an example of that process. I might pause here and just say that a lot of times when we think of climate stress and scenario testing, the purpose is to understand the risks posed by climate change. But there's another element of this also in terms of the opportunities. And I think there's a much bigger drive coming from that perspective of understanding not only the risks and the opportunities. So in that respect, when we're looking at these drivers, we're trying to understand both. So therefore, we're trying to understand factors that might increase mortality rates, but also decrease mortality rates. And then from there, you can step it back. So what could potentially decrease mortality rates? Well, migration could be an element of decreasing mortality rates, and the narrative there goes through a change in business mix. But then if you look on the other side, in terms of increasing mortality rates, there are various aspects that could potentially impact that as well. And again, if you can step that through and attach it to a climate driver at the end, that's the purpose of this part of the exercise. So hopefully what you're now reading to see is that there's some common themes that are coming up in this exercise and the strands that you can start to see how things are interconnected. So for example, if we look at mass migration, we can see that mass migration has the potential not only to potentially increase mortality rates, but also decrease mortality rates depending on how it changes mix of business. It might also have an impact on how the the healthcare system is, how overloaded that healthcare system is, and once that healthcare system is overloaded, that could have an impact on degrading overall health. So what you can see now is that there are certain elements, and this is specifically what we're looking for, where elements are interconnected, where elements can particularly amplify in that last block. So once you have a view of those drivers and you have a view of how those drivers can step through in a narrative that impacts objectives you care about, we then move on to developing a climate register. The aim of this register is to explicitly set out assumptions so that these can be challenged for future exercises, but it's also a means for starting to add exposure around the metrics that we have identified. Broadly, the content of this register can be divided into three sections. The first section is setting out the causal relationships from the climate driver to the objectives you care about. So using the mapping exercise that we've done before, setting out the climate driver that we're looking in our register, how that impacts our objectives that we care about, and that might come through in various strands as we've seen. Then we're also trying to understand the exact underlying risks from that driver that we care about in this framework. There's also an important element here of starting to establish interconnections and understand where things from our mapping could be very complex and occur in different ways. The next part is about developing a sense of the materiality of these drivers, and that's done through research, considering the time horizons that drivers could potentially emerge, also considering the materiality of these drivers, and doing any sort of impact assessments on your objectives. The research should be aimed specifically at the link between the driver and the impact that the business has specified that they care about. And must also take into account sort of relevant structures of the problem. So, for example, are you dealing with this particular product line? Are you dealing with particular demographics? Are you looking in a specific geographical region? So at this stage, it might be necessary to conduct some focused stress testing, and this is where the quantification element comes in. So to do stress testing, just to help understand some of those exposures and add it to this table, so that you can move on to the next bit, which is the expert opinion. So once we've set out all the information, it's up to the business to come up with an expert opinion and clearly state those assumptions in terms of how it thinks climate can impact their business through the drivers identified. So if we so the importance of that is now there is a structured way that has been set up. So if any of those underlying elements of the register change, you can go back and look at that expert opinion and update that as necessary. So if we move back to our example, here we have looked specifically, we've pulled out mass migration and extreme heat. We've gone through a dummy exercise of completing the register, and at the end, the expert opinion has said that for our business and in the UK, we don't think extreme heat will be very material for the insured population. However, mass migration, not necessarily mass migration in itself could be material, but due to the impacts that it could have on overloading the healthcare industry, there is some concern there. Because if the National Health Service, the NHS, becomes overloaded, there could be an impact on having earlier deaths as well as additional deaths as a result. The last step is then, the step is then now to actually design decision-useful climate scenario narratives from the building blocks that we've defined in the register before. So this is so that the scenario can be presented to the group who is interested in discussing, and through exploring that scenario, come up with some decisions in terms of whether or how the what needs to be addressed for that specific scenario and what measures can be put in place in the present to become more climate resilient. So as I said, we would use the climate register as your building blocks for this narrative. And what we're trying to do is pull some of those blocks from the climate register into a scenario such that the scenario results in something that impacts one or more of our key business objectives that we've identified in the problem statement. The scenario must sound plausible and consider expert judgments that have been formed in that climate register in the step before. And then also the scenario should describe the factors leading up to an outcome, not just the final outcome. Because it's through that leading up to an outcome where we can start exploring the scenario and understanding, would we have seen it coming? Is there something else we can do to kind of, to develop our climate resilience? So then we want to explore that scenario, not just in terms of plausibility, because the plausibility comes from how that scenario was put together, but to say that if it occurred, what does this mean for our business? And it's through this exploration that the organization can start developing their climate resilience. For some organizations, this might be a big enough step to getting to this point of being able to qualitatively develop climate narratives that are decision useful and exploring these topics. The benefit of this approach is that once you have that climate register set up, the building blocks can be pulled together fairly easily, and these types of scenarios can be investigated or discussed on a regular basis, even monthly, and doesn't require a huge amount of effort to do that. So if we go back to our example, in this case, what we've looked at, and I appreciate there's a lot of information here, so I'll give you an overview, the slides I'm sure will be available at the end to go into more detail. So what we've considered here is setting up a scenario where there's been volatile economic conditions in the UK, and this has been going on for a prolonged period. The impact of that is that on the NHS, the National Health Service, there has been continual strain on not only funding for the service, but also in terms of their own expense load. Individuals have also been impacted by these economic conditions in terms of cost of living, so potentially affordability of products like whole of life become more expensive, and we're seeing additional lapses in that area. On top of that, the NHS also becomes strained because of events happening from climate change. So additional demand on the service for heat-related stress, but also potentially vector diseases, and potentially mass migration sees the NHS just become overloaded with the reduced funding to the point that they're on the brink of collapse. And as a result, general health in the population deteriorates. All of this has a knock-on effect on the UK economy, and we see the pound deteriorating and asset values falling, and which potentially has a knock-on impact on reserves. So now we've developed a scenario which you can take back to the individuals who are interested in this. We've had conversations of these at risk committee levels, at board levels. And now discussing through that scenario, what does that particularly mean for our business? What are some of the no-regret actions we can take now to become more climate resilient? So in this slide, you can see we've gone through where the business is exposed to risks in the scenario. We've understand where different climate pathways might make the scenario more or less likely. But then the last 2 points is the crux of what we're trying to get to. What does that mean for us? And what are the decisions that we can take as a result? So for the scenario, it potentially means that whole-of-life products become more expensive to administer in the future, and they're also very hard to price as the future becomes more uncertain. The one thing that maybe points out in the scenario is that because the healthcare system is not something that you traditionally see in a key risk indicator matrix, we probably wouldn't have realized that this situation was happening. And I think this is the crux of climate scenarios, that a lot can be going on under the surface, and it's only at the point where things break where it becomes a huge factor. But if you had known what to look for, you might have been seeing some of these developments up until that point. So one of the decisions we can make, a low-cost, no-regret decision, is to actually start monitoring what's happening in the healthcare system in terms of waiting times and looking at the funding levels that the UK is getting. So that by monitoring that, at some point, there could be a trigger where we need to have these conversations to understand where this trend could plausibly go. I think the other thing that I was trying to, or that the working party was trying to to demonstrate with a scenario, is that when we talk about climate scenarios, it is not enough to think of climate in a silo, because that is not how our risks will emerge. Climate risk is not a risk on its own. Climate risk is a risk accelerator, and it will impact risks across our business. So you can see we've not only taken things from our climate register, we've taken topical items as well and put them together and interwoven them to a plausible story that could happen. But it's important to keep that context in mind. And although it's a climate scenario, what it ultimately ends up is an economic stress. So hopefully by now you can see that going through this framework, developing climate narratives in this way can be very decision useful and can help decisions for an organization. Most scenarios would only be explored qualitatively, as discussed, but there may be some scenarios that your organization would want to explore quantitatively. And the narratives of how these scenarios have developed and looking at where your exposures lie from that scenario should give you some indication of a proxy scenario that you can build within your existing models to demonstrate these. As when we started the working party, we quickly realized that the quantitative aspect of climate stress and scenario testing is obviously extremely complex. There's also a lot of information available in this area. And as such, the decision was taken to only touch on the quantitative aspect very briefly, but focus on the qualitative aspect, because it's even at this stage where insurers need to get better at, and that's within the UK environment as well, being able to quantitatively think about the future and what climate could mean. So in our example, again, with the way we've constructed that scenario, there are some aspects that we've pulled out in terms of increased mortality, maybe reduced new business sales, increased lapses. And for quantifying that scenario, these impacts can be put into your current models to sort of form a proxy of how that scenario was discussed to provide further information on the scenario that you've developed. So thank you for your time. I think we now have maybe 5 or 10 minutes to go into questions, which are for both Pam and I's section.
Are there any questions before I go online?
Thank you. So my question is, I think it was Pamela when you first presented and you were looking at the actual direct impact of climate. I just wanted to know what potential risk do we have that we might understate or maybe overstate, but possibly understate the actual risk given the other causal effects of climate change. Like, for example, you get floods in Durban, then you, because of that you have contaminated water sources and that leads to increased mortality and morbidity. Or, you know, you have a drought and that results in malnutrition and so it's like a cascade, you know, cascading effects. Have we, and will we be doing work to look at that impact overall in the short or long term? Thank you.
Is that for me? Okay. Sorry, I don't know if I caught the whole question, but I think it was to do with the kind of cascading impacts of climate events on health and, you know, hunger, malnutrition, all that. As far as the working party is concerned, we are just to make this work kind of doable and able to make some progress, we're only focusing on the direct first-order impacts of climate change on our on mortality and morbidity. So we'll look at how many extra people die or get sick as a direct result of heat stress or of drought or of rising sea levels. We won't really go into the malnutrition and that kind of thing. Adal, I don't know if you have any thoughts on that question.
Yeah, it's complex. you know, the problem with a risk like climate is that it is so complex. It's not linear. It's interconnected. There are things that can happen that we haven't even considered, and we don't even have concept of where things could go potentially if we consider tipping points and extremes. But I think it makes sense for working parties to kind of corner off what they're looking at, because as I said, once you start unpicking this problem, it is so difficult to get to all the nitty-gritty. But having said that, it is worth exploring those interactions. It is worth exploring those second-order effects. And I think that is where developing good narratives that you can explore qualitatively and doing this on a regular basis. So I think we're used to exploring, you know, these narratives maybe once a year for an author, but doing these monthly so that you can do as multiple scenarios as possible and try and address as much of the problem as possible, I think is the way to go.
So another question that's online. How do you consider longer-term risks and get a board to understand the impact of climate risk when ORSA usually goes to 5 years only?
It has to become a problem that the company cares about in terms of its survival, because ultimately that's where those longer-term risks are coming in. So again, I will state again, it's not just about the risks, but it's the opportunities. Are there things, when we're looking at those longer-term horizons, that can present not only risks to the organizations, but opportunities where, as a first mover, you have an advantage in that area? So it has to become important at a much higher level to understand what the risks and opportunities on climate can be, so that it moves past this ORSA scenario and trying to address regulatory concerns.
Pamela, we're just curious, what are other actual societies doing around the world in terms of looking at morbidity and mortality impacts on climate change?
So our working party is actually established as a result of the IFAA doing similar work towards the end of last year, and they asked, you know, what's ASSA doing? I'm in regular contact with the IFAA working party as well as the Singapore Actuarial Society working party. So it seems like a lot of societies around the world are only starting to look at this kind of thinking or risk with any kind of rigor. So as far as the IFAA is concerned and the Singapore Actuarial Society and then also the IAA that we've been speaking about, I think even the work that our working party has done to date is quite advanced, in terms of the rest of the world. So we are constantly sharing ideas and hoping to do some work together to actually illustrate how different the impacts of climate change can be depending on your region. So as I said in my presentation, South Africa is going to experience climate change very differently from Singapore. So are we interested to see what the results of that research will be.
Okay, thank you. Are there any other questions? You mentioned some modeling work that you guys are doing. What would be the next steps regarding that work?
So the modeling work is probably what most actuaries would be interested in. So we want to, our goal by the end of the year is to produce some kind of industry-wide study where we do, you know, the graphs and things I showed are very, you know, first glance, very first draft versions of what we can do. So I'm talking to a number of life insurers, medical aid providers, and also the CSI committee to get hold of industry-wide data that we can perform similar analysis for, and hopefully get an industry view of what extreme temperatures will do to our insured population. And that's something we can publish, and hopefully insurers can use those results for their own analysis instead of having to do the work themselves.
Okay, thank you. There's a question over there.
So if you look at sort of the last 200 years, you've seen large improvements in mortality, and they've been pretty, I mean, except for volatility, they've been pretty sort of consistent over time. Now, I think that shows humans' ability to be able to adapt as a whole, as a collective across the globe. So obviously countries sort of fall in and out of that, but as a collective, this is what's happened. And is climate change not just another one of those challenges, but that trend will continue? So actually, we're talking about, instead of a deterioration in long-term mortality, we're talking potentially just a slowdown of the level of improvements.
So slowdown of the level of improvements have already started. If you're familiar with the CMI work in the UK, you can find that on the IFO website. Yes, it's a fair point. I think to date, in the UK as experience, a lot of focus has been given on what will be business as usual. And maybe business as usual, you're right, we will adapt, things will adjust, and we'll have time to price for these. But what we need to start looking at as the actual society is what extremes can happen. And that's exactly what's going to happen with climate. So climate is going to be, as I said, a risk accelerator across our other risks. So what are the extreme events that can happen as a result of climate drivers? And some of it is not necessarily just climate topics. I think some of the things we're looking at is, for example, the transition to a low carbon economy. The materials needed for these new technologies are potentially in countries that are not friendly and that we have do not have trade agreements. So what happens when these countries start using that for their own purposes and we have increased geopolitical conflict, we have increases in or decreases in the resources that we have available to build these transitions. And so it's things like that, and that blows up. You know, where does that lead? Does that lead to a war? And so ultimately, it's not necessarily the climate change that's going to be the big risks that I think we need to look at, because as you say, we can adapt, we can potentially reprice for those. But what are the compounding effects? What are the nonlinear effects? What are those extremes and in the tails that we're potentially not yet looking at because we've been so focused on what are plausible futures? And it's moving away from those plausible futures, whereas as an actual society, we need to get to.
No, thank you. We'll leave it there. Thank you so much, Pamela and Adele, for your feedback. And again, a special thanks to Adele. She's not a member of ESSA, for coming to present to us.
Thank you.
This is the end of the session. Tea and coffee will be served. We'll reconvene at 11:15 for the session covering product rationalization. Thank you.